me a job down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a mill is ill. I can pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM, and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. CFA is proud to support community radio and the Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting cfaillinois.org. This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus, and I want to just wish everyone out there a happy May Day. There was a great May Day rally on the Quad on the U of I campus yesterday. A lot of great speakers, and I want to also give thanks to Elizabeth Simpson and her band. Woody's Wake, I think it was his name. And they did a couple great union songs, traditional ones. It's the first time I heard them perform, and I thought Elizabeth had a great voice, especially on the song 16 Tons that she did. Excellent speakers, including our own very own Gus Wood. Even though it's celebrating May Day, it was primarily organized because of what's currently going on at the University of Illinois and the striking non-tenured faculty union members. And in fact, we've got one of their members here today in the studio who we're going to be getting to very shortly to talk some more about what's been achieved so far, but what still has to be obtained here in the coming days, hopefully not too many more days. So first we're going to go to some what's been happening around the country, around the world, starting, I guess, with Gus.
Yeah, in keeping with the theme of striking militant labor action, there's been the big strike, the Verizon worker strike that's been going on right now. So we got a couple of updates on that. So striking Verizon workers are reacting strongly to the ultimatum that was delivered by management this past Thursday. Company officials declared that the concessionary proposal they handed the union was management's, quote, last, best, and final, end quote, offer as the strike by 39,000-plus workers continues into the third week. So workers also face an April 30 cutoff of health benefits. Mm. So the company is determined to continue slashing jobs in its drive to increase productivity and profits. Central to its plans are measures to drive out older, better-paid workers who will be replaced by new hires with no employer-paid pensions.
Uh-huh.
So in particular, management wants to change work rules to force employees to travel long distances to temporary work assignments as well. So the company is also offering a 7.5% wage increase over the next 3 years, while at the same time forcing workers to pay higher out-of-pocket health care costs or switch to an inferior coverage, which we know is a traditional historical thing that employers do during contract negotiations for labor disputes. This is in line with the so-called, quote, Cadillac tax, end quote, included in Obama's Affordable Health Care Act, which punishes health care plans that are supposedly too generous. So in response to the management ultimatum, the union has offered empty bluster, but no way forward for striking workers, continuing its practice of working with management to enforce concessions. So we're starting to see a little bit of what happens with the UAW in the sense that you have the union bosses not working in the interest of the rank and file striking members. So, again, that separation between the leadership and the rank and file continues to haunt union history and labor strikes and disputes in this country. So hopefully, we don't see that happening for different groups as well, but we're hoping that Verizon rank and file step up and challenge their bosses to say, no, we're not going to take this austerity measure.
Yeah, like they did in UAW here just a short time ago.
Oh, our favorite Dennis Williams.
Yeah.
I hope he's listening too.
It's funny. Two issues came out there, both as far as pensions and health care. My wife's from Germany originally, and they don't have pensions. They have just basically Social Security that they retire with. Now, they pay double you know, what we pay as far as a worker, what's deducted.
Sure.
But they retire at their Social Security pensions, that's equivalent to their take-home pay.
Yeah.
So there's basically, once you retire there, you're still getting the same amount of money every month as you did when you worked full-time. Mm-hmm. Okay. If we would go to a system like that instead of corporate America always fighting it, corporate America could save all that money that they say they're so stressed to pay as far as funding pension funds. The other thing, single payer health care. Another thing that corporate America opposes, you know, mm-hmm. that if they get behind, they could, you know, also, you know, not be so stressed, you know, that,
exactly,
you know. But yet, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it too. It seems like, you know, they, of course, they want to, make as much profit as they possibly can, but at the same time, there's ideological baggage there, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the key part really, Dave, mm-hmm. is the ideological conflict. I mean, the interests of the workers are clearly in direct conflict with the interests of corporations because let's be honest, it makes much more sense to go to that type of system where you do pay more taxes, but you're getting more material benefits for the more money that you're paying. I mean, it makes clearly more sense in those countries that do that, like Sweden, where their healthcare and their education is free, mm-hmm. and places like Cuba as well. You do see a standard of living where things are taken care of that people don't have to struggle over. And I'm talking about basic material needs that class struggle historically has always dealt with. Those things don't exist in those types of countries. But again, it comes to this idea of power and this ideological struggle. Yeah. I'm not going to let the majority determine their own destiny. Mm-hmm. I'm going to determine it for them.
You know, it does come down to that a lot of times, is the whole issue of control, you know, and power. You know, so just some real quick things that's been going on around the country here. United Airlines flight attendants picketed airports in Chicago, Los Angeles, Honolulu, Newark, San Francisco, and Washington D.C. Thursday. The AFA CWA president Sarah Nelson says the flight attendants are picketing for a fair contract with the merged United Airlines. Nelson says amid record profits for the airline, flight attendants deserve and expect to share in those profits with an industry leading labor contract. Same old story.
Oh yeah.
You know, it looks like an interesting happened in Germany. About 80 independent pilots association UIPS pilots are honoring picket lines in Cologne, Germany for a 24-hour strike of German UPS workers. Also, it looks like out in the West Coast, on International Workers Day, May 1st, members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 10 in San Francisco, will be calling for a national day of mourning for black and brown unarmed victims of police killings. Now, this is interesting because the ILWU, the International Longshoremen's Union, was established after the West Coast waterfront strike and San Francisco general strike of 1934, where maritime workers faced massive police violence, including the murder of two of their own dock workers.
Yeah.
Both shot in the back, I might add.
Yeah, longshoremen striking history and just labor militancy history in general is really, like, very extensive and hasn't been written about as much. And I think we really should do a show on that because some of the earliest strikes in American history happened with the longshoremen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know about that history. You know, it goes back to, like, right after the Civil War. There were a couple of militant disputes before the Civil War as well. But right after, you saw a bunch of, like, strike fever going on right after the end. So we should do a show about
it. Well, coming
that.
Up this summer, I think we need to delve into some of this history, Gus, needs to be talked about.
Yeah, but tying back into what you just said about police violence, you know, that's something that we're starting to see a decline in. Is that the national media is not talking about police brutality anymore. Ever since the wave of it in the past couple of years and dealing with Baltimore, Ferguson, and all these different other issues, you're starting to see, I said over the past 3 months that the number of murders continued. I mean, they're not regressing at all, but the media coverage is starting to decline.
Yes.
And this is what the petty bourgeoisie usually does in terms of the media coverage. Their idea of in this racial color blindness garbage is that, and this is not a joke, this is what they really argue, that if you stop talking about it and if you take it away, then it'll somehow decrease.
Mm-hmm.
So stop talking about race and stop talking about any type of discrimination and then it'll just leave the air. It'll leave the atmosphere, which is the most ridiculous illogical argument because what happened in Baltimore, they just, a 14-year-old boy was just shot who had a BB gun in the back running away from police officers.
Mm-hmm.
So another shooting in a city that was ravaged by a rebellion. You know, that's not only dealing with police violence, but also dealing with what Capitol has done to the communities in Baltimore.
When I was growing up, I remember occasionally a police car would drive down the street we were playing on, and we'd point our toy guns at them when they come down the street. I mean, today I guess that could cause some of us to be killed doing that sort of thing. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, in the historical parts of Champaign, there were parts of the city where the community told the police, listen, you're not coming in here because when you do come in here, somebody ends up dead or they end up hurt. Yeah. So we're going to police ourselves, mm-hmm. and you're not coming in here anymore. And many of them adhere to that rule, mm-hmm. and it stopped a lot of violence within the community and stopped violence between the community and police. But for some reason, not for some reason, the petty bourgeoisie hate this idea of community control and police civilian review boards. Mm-hmm. I mean, just having some type of control over who polices our people, because what the civilian review board is going to do is they're going to offer to make police live in the communities that they police, which of course, the police forces hate that, mm-hmm. because it's been shown that, and this is from a lot of psychologists and sociologists, that the more, the bigger relationships you have amongst people, the less violence is more likely to occur. So living in the community yeah. has shown that the police officers will develop relationships with the people and not shoot them.
I mean, that's because backed up with data, but I mean, it seems like a pretty common sense concept to me, you know?
Well, let's be honest. That's because the police are not set up to develop relationships among people and to keep civilian peace. Their job is to keep the status quo. Serve and protect. Serve the rich, protect private property. Mm-hmm. Plain and simple.
Yes. Okay, any other news that you might want to share with the listeners?
I mean, I got some more stuff that we're probably going to come through in this throughout this hour, but I definitely want to turn it over and make sure Christina gets as much time as possible. So I'll save this for later.
Okay, very good. You know, yeah. Okay, Christina, welcome back to the World Labor Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, could you introduce yourself again to the listeners?
Of course. My name is Christina D'Angelo. I am an instructor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at the University of Illinois here in town, and I am also the chair of the strike committee of the Non-Tenure Faculty Coalition.
Okay, so you guys, since we talked last, you came in here, I think, right before you were here last, right before you did your first two-day strike, and you've done a couple of those, and where are we at now? I mean, you've gotten some progress by having a couple of two-day strikes, and then most recently a little longer one?
Yes, so 2 weeks ago we went out on a limited two-day strike, and it was announced two-day strike to get potentially some more mediation dates or to get the upper administration involved in getting our contract moving forward. Unfortunately, we didn't get any new dates after that first two-day strike, so we waited until this last week on Wednesday. We had a mediation session that ended up extending into the evening. It was a morning session scheduled originally, and it extended into the evening, where we hoped there would be movement on our main issues, as a result of our work stoppage the week before. And we had a membership meeting planned for that evening to discuss the progress and think about what our options were. Unfortunately, that full day session that was extended into the evening didn't come back with any results on our key issues, which have to do with job security primarily, so multi-year contracts and appointment reappointment notifications. Our key issues, mostly because many of our members, even those that have been here for over 10 years, still have year-to-year contracts, 9-month contracts, and do not have any specific rights to when or if they are told they will be retained for the next year until they've already started working. So we didn't see any movement, and the administration knew that we were having a meeting that could potentially result in another strike vote. And unfortunately, they gave a final proposal knowing that we were in that room together and left our bargaining team at the session. So we didn't have the movement we wanted to, and our members voted again for a 5-day work stoppage. So that would push into next week and the remainder of the semester.
I was confused. I thought it was two days, but it was a 2-day and then a 5-day.
Yes. Okay. So we're currently in the middle of a potential 5-day strike.
Okay.
So it happened that it started in midweek, so we had the last 2 days, and yesterday we finally saw some real movement.
Okay.
So
what's this now? You first your 2-day, and now here into the 5-day strike. I mean, what's the effect of this been? I mean, on business as usual at the university.
Well, our first 2-day strike was definitely a little bit more anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of communication with those that work in the building that was picketed. There was the opportunity for folks to move their classes or cancel their classes with a lot more notice. And last week, our first 2-day strike, which was 2 weeks ago, we did see there was very little movement happening in the English building during those 2 days. People definitely, respected our picket lines and moved their business to other places or canceled, some in solidarity and walked with us instead. The last 2 days have been a little bit different because the community didn't have as much notice to respond,
mm-hmm.
But many did very, very quickly, which was something that is a pretty amazing thing to see, the type of solidarity that we've received. People don't want to cross picket lines.
Okay,
and our community's really been amazing in that.
Great. Now, I mean, we're getting close to the end of the semester here, right? So, I mean, it's kind of, as far as, papers have to be graded and, finals are coming up and stuff. So, I mean, I would think, this is putting a lot of pressure on the, administration.
It's a really a critical time. It's very stressful for our members.
I can imagine, yes.
It's a stressful time for, our members' students, definitely. and this is not something that we wanted to have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is the position that the administration has put us in. By not resolving our outstanding issues earlier in the semester. I think we would have all really liked to have had this done a few months ago.
Sure.
And here we are. So we hope, and it does seem like, the administration is seeing how critical this time period is for the students, that we are responsible for. So we got an extra date. Our bargaining team is in session right now.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that we the best part about the undergraduates understanding this process is that, strikes have always been considered, particularly amongst people who don't know much about them, as something that comes about easily. You just sit down one day, you decide to have a strike. But there is so much conflict and so many dynamics involved in making a strike vote. And it's also a very last resort type mechanism that you to withhold your labor is something that nobody wants to do, because that's because we're workers. That's what we do. We want to, especially as teachers, educate our students.
Mm-hmm.
So to withhold the labor of that, that's something that a lot of professors, a lot of people just said, I don't want to do this. This is something that took a lot of time to happen. But again, as we talked about in the past, there comes a point to where militancy is something that it's in your head when you're going through an oppressive state. You have to go through something to get you to that point to where you say, yeah, this is terrible, but if I don't do this, things are going to get much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what many groups, particularly in labor history, have talked about. And that's why we're doing this on May Day. It's so important, is that people reach that point to where they said, yeah, we could be shot down by the police if we do this. Yeah, we could lose money. Yeah, we could hurt our students' education, but we would be hurting everything if we don't make this stand.
Sure.
So that's what I'm saying. These types of things are important, not just for the moment, but to understand the class struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's why we really got to make sure we teach this to the students, even after it's over and while it's going on. Make sure the students understand what types of dynamics and how complicated it is to get to this point of militancy labor action.
I was really encouraged to hear that a lot of the undergraduates were honoring the picket lines and stuff. I wondered about that going into that because, the composition of the student body has changed a lot over the last, in my lifetime anyway,
yes,
last 30, 40 years. So that's really encouraging, to hear that.
It really is just a testament to the quality of educators that we have as members and the quality of educators that we have as graduate employees and tenure track on campus that are working with us to let students know why we're out there and what this is and how it relates to larger labor issues and how it relates to the state of higher education right now. I think most of our students, when we speak to them about why we're doing this and how we got to this point and why we want a contract in the first place and how that will impact our ability to be there for them as researchers and instructors in a more productive way. Students have responded to that, and it's really amazing to hear and meet other students of members of our union come walk with us, and they really get why we're out there, and they support us. I have so many stories of the last few weeks interacting with people on the lines, and one of the most amazing things that I heard is our members are going to their students and telling them, you know, our members are communicating what this is about and making sure that they understand why we have been pushed to this point. And many of our members, students are coming to walk with us, you know, and they're not just taking this as, oh, I get a day off of class, isn't that great? Or this is terrible, why would you do this to me right now? They're saying, if I can help make this move forward right now, I'm going to walk with you too. A member went to her class and said, I feel terrible, this is so conflicting for me, but I feel like I really need to do this, and I'm doing this for you. And her students told her to go out to the picket line.
Oh man, that's really inspiring.
Yeah. So it's great to see when students walk away with a flyer that explains why we're out there, that they're really reading them, and many of them come back with questions. We've had a lot of student journalists come approach us on the lines and want to know why we're there, and they already know what our key issues are. So that's been pretty great.
Good. You know, it's just, it still ceases to amaze me, just, you know, the conditions of non-tenured faculty. I mean, my God, I mean, you know, there's gotta be a heck of a turnover every year and stuff. I mean, you know, the thing is with this, you know, job instability and, you know, it's just, it's long overdue, so I guess what I'm saying here. I mean, this is, you know, it's not like the university can't afford this. I mean, you know, it's just, it just makes me so angry, you know, that they're acting like they're some kind of corporate sweatshop, you know.
Which they are.
Okay. You know, the way they treat their most valuable, you know, employees. I mean, all their employees are valuable, but I'm saying, my God, the graduate students and the non-tenured faculty. I mean, that's the core of a university. I mean, come on.
But you see, and that's, again, we got to go back into this ideological issue. You know, the administration is stacked with people who have never taught in the classroom before.
Uh-huh.
You know, these are corporate people. They're coming from corporate backgrounds. I mean, they worked for businesses before, and how to, you know.
So they bring somebody that used to work for McDonald's or Kraft, and they put them into the university as an administrator.
Work in their corporate offices. See,
okay.
That's their experiences. Their interests and experiences are in direct conflict with the experiences of the workers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what we have to make sure we understand, that this is not something where there can be real, I mean, there's going to be, of course, the only way you're going to make your point across is to have a militant labor action, because the interest of that group does not meet our interests, and we're never going to meet unless we push our hand.
Yeah.
Because that's the makeup of the administration there.
Sure.
I mean,
and never mind the best interest of the students or the, you know, the, university in general.
To put teachers at the head of one of the largest universities and that makes more money than most universities in this country, that would be insane, because they would lose that profit margin that they want to see. That's why they go and get those corporate people who have no respect and who disrespect teachers, students, faculty, staff on the campus every day, because that's the way they've been trained to treat the people as machines in the working class. I mean, mm-hmm. that's their mentality. Yeah. That's their ideology.
And we've seen in the bargaining room too that it is a challenge for the administration's team to really even understand what it is that we do as educators.
Plus being rude and disrespectful, if I might understand.
We have had some challenges. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it comes back to exactly the interest that the bargaining team of the administration have and are setting forward in their negotiations don't really speak to or address a lot of the issues we're trying to resolve, because they don't necessarily understand exactly what our day-to-day work entails.
Okay. So, what's happening next, Christina?
Well, so, since we voted, on Wednesday evening to go out, potentially for a 5-day strike, we have gotten 3 new bargaining dates that, so that would be an indication to me that hopefully the administration takes this seriously and will make this come to a good conclusion soon.
Okay.
Yesterday during the May Day rally when we were all together, which was really great, and I wanted to say thank you for organizing that. It was a wonderful thing to have such great speakers from all over our community come together. I thought it was really, really wonderful. But we heard our president, Sean Gilmore, said that, in session yesterday, they added a Saturday date.
Which, okay.
You know, after months and months of hearing that they didn't have time to meet with us,
mm-hmm.
Right now on a Saturday, it's 11:30. They've been there since 9 a.m.
Okay.
They're there having a mediation session, and I really hope, I haven't heard, what's going on, but I really hope that we get some movement on our key issue multi-year contracts. If we don't, we're prepared to go out again on Monday.
Okay, they have agreed to a couple things though.
Yes, okay. Yes, we have made some movement in the last 2 days, which just shows the strength of our community and the strength of the action that we're taking right now. We did get some language on one of our key issues, which is appointment reappointment. And that's really, really, really encouraging.
Okay.
To hear that we're finally being heard on issues of job security. We also got some language on academic freedom as well. And some of our other outstanding issues have been being exchanged. We don't have any tentative agreements from yesterday yet, but we do see some positive movement. So I hope that that continues today. I know that our bargaining team is willing to stay as long as it takes, if it means that we can resolve this weekend and not go out again
okay.
on Monday.
And, of course, members of the community can help by coming and walking with you guys. I know I came 2 weeks ago, and, boy, I tell you, guys have some really great picket lines. I mean, it's lively, and it's actually even fun. You know, you got some great people leading, some chants and, you know, everything. And
a lot of that energy comes from seeing people coming out with us. You know, it really makes a difference. And for anyone that has ever seen a picket line or heard of a community union going out, I want to say that from my personal experience, that support, if it's a half an hour, if it's 10 minutes, that support is what gets people through their day. So that's been really, really important. And I think it's been really great also, you know, educating the community on campus about what picket lines are and how to observe those and what you can do to help.
Okay.
And that is one of the great things.
What else can people do? I heard that you're encouraging people to call a chancellor's office.
Yes. So we think that, you know, at this point, it is really important that the upper administration gets involved with having this contract settled. So sure. We would encourage anyone who thinks that that this contract should get resolved, they can go ahead and make their voice heard by contacting the interim chancellor.
Okay, and her name's Barb Wilson, is that
yes,
correct?
That's
and right. Her phone number is 217-333-6290. That's 217-333-6290. And that's interim chancellor Barb Wilson. I said it with irony, of course. We won't. That's almost another show talking about what's been going on at the university administration the last few years. But I mean, but it just shows what kind of people you're dealing with, unfortunately. And anything else that you'd like to, you know, let our listeners know about today while you're here?
I think I'd just like to say I have been really overwhelmed by the support we've gotten from the community, and I'm very, very proud of the strength and endurance of our members right now. So I say stay tuned and, you know, we'll let everyone know how today goes. And if it goes how we'd like, we won't be out. But if it doesn't, then we'll be out in force on Monday and we would That's love right. everyone's support.
Okay, Christina. Well, thank you so much, for coming in and, you'll definitely, keep us posted. If you, you know, we, of course, we'll do, you know, news, keep our listeners informed and stuff. If you want to send us
you.
Press releases or whatever.
Yeah.
And, we'll go from there. So, okay. You're listening to the World Labor on the Supporting Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We're going to take a quick music break and we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes. Miss a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. This a war that until that day the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war. War. And until the ignoble and unhappy regime that hold our brothers in Angola, in Mozambique, South Africa, subhuman bondage, have been toppled, totally destroyed. Well, everywhere is war. Miss a war. War in the east. War in the west. War up north. War down south. War, war. Rumors of a war. And until that day, the
Okay, we're back. There's a couple of tracks. First one was from Bob Marley. The title of that was War. And the second one was from Tom Morello. And that one was It Begins Tonight. So we're going to be playing a little bit of music here on and off during the course of the program today, which we're going to extend a little bit. Because we want to talk about May Day, you know, both past and present. And I think there's, you know, a lot of significance. Of course, you know, the history of May Day and the celebration of May Day has been suppressed in this country, you know, for well, it's the 130th anniversary actually this year.
Yep.
And everything, and in fact they went to such a great length to suppress May Day, they actually made May 1st for the longest time, you'd see it on calendars as Law Day or Legal Day, you know, I don't think it's on there anymore, but, you know, but, anyway, some real quick, public service announcements, starting with, today, and every Saturday from, 2 to 3 p.m., tune in to None Other Sports Show at 104.5 FMW RFU with, host, fellow worker Neil Parthen. And this Sunday and every Sunday, tune in to Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 on Comcast Channel 6 and UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. And, this, Sunday will be a film about the history of May Day, so tune into that. And we did get some film footage at the May Day event yesterday at the U of I campus, and awesome. As soon as possible, we're going to be airing that, as soon as I can get some a little bit of time here to go in and do some a little bit of editing on it for broadcasting. But what's really exciting here is coming up tomorrow at the Art Theater in downtown Champaign. Monday. May 2nd at the Art Theater Co-op in downtown Champaign at 7:30 p.m. is the film The Strange Victory. And this is being sponsored by the North End Breakfast Club.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. And this, I tell you, the history of this film, it's only $5. And, you know, last time North End Breakfast Club did a film at the Art, it was very successful. It was about the Black Panthers, Vanguards of the Revolution.
That's right.
And, I mean, for a Monday night, that place was packed,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it was actually overflowing, like, there were people like there were literally no seats available, and then of course we had the panel discussion afterwards.
Yes.
And yeah, that was,
and there's going to be a panel discussion after this one on Monday as well, right?
Yeah, I think so. I believe so. I think we're still double checking on
okay.
that, but you know, we'll see. It depends on the time, and yeah.
Well, yeah, the history of this film itself is as interesting as the film.
Yeah.
It says, it was a quote from the Jay Hoberman from the Village Voice, quote, the most ambitious leftist film made in the U.S. between Native Land and Soul of the Earth.
That's right.
In this documentary noir. And like Soul of the Earth, this film was, both blacklisted and, forgot about for decades. Said the blacklisted filmmaker, Leo Hurwitz and, Barney Rossette produced this potent and uncompromising look at racism in post-war America in 1948. Strange Victory courageously compares the U.S. with Nazi Germany and finds the ideas of the loser still active in the land of the winner.
Sure.
Although rarely seen, as bold documentary equals the visual poetic brilliance of Battleship Potemkin and I Am Cuba, while delivering an extraordinary cry from the heart to make our country a better place for future generations. It was made during a time when any critique of the American society or politics was seen as bordering on treason.
Yeah.
And almost 70 years after the film premiered, it has lost none of its power or relevance. What did the victory over Hitler mean for American society? The United States had won the war, but the film asks why. In the country of the victors are the ideas of the defeated still in fashion. I mean, that's powerful
yeah.
statement,
I mean,
just that, you know.
I mean, the stuff that France Fanon was doing and the stuff that other black radicals were doing in the U.S., they already were making these types of arguments, but of course they were blacklisted, and they were also, you know, the Cold War stuff was coming in, and the Civil Rights Movement came in and hurt that type of argument as well. But, you know, you start reading, there are scholars today that are just understanding what that atmosphere was like in the 1940s and post-war America going into the 50s, and what it did in setting up, getting ready for, even though I don't like this term because they don't use it correctly, but setting up ghettoization,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how they start creating these urban spaces of complete and utter apartheid conditions, you know. And, you know, like people, a lot of people thought that stuff started in the 70s and 80s
mm-hmm.
with, you know, when deindustrialization happened. Like, no, this stuff started way earlier when they started and so yeah, these are major arguments that people today are just starting to grasp
mm-hmm.
because of the repression of those types of films that were coming out in the 40s and in the 50s when people were making these types of radical arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
And we kind of touched on this last week, and that is that this time period, I mean, there was huge advances made for working people during the 1930s because there was open revolt. You know, things, economic conditions got so bad, and everything. And then World War II came along, and I mean, within a, the war wasn't even over yet. It looked like it was going to be won definitely in the last year or so, that 1944 period starting and then continuing after the war into the, you know, 46, 47. I mean, that was a really pivotal moment in U.S. history for the worse, unfortunately.
Oh, of course, definitely. I mean, and we know the 30s are the radical 30s. Mm-hmm. I mean, for both, for multiple races, for the working class in general, like you say, it got to a point to where there was no turning back, and you saw some of the most fervent militancy on the ground in communities during the 1930s, the radical 30s. You had some major rebellions in urban cities. I mean, it was just so much action. But again, with that type, it works in dialectics. You're going to have a repression of that came into the
counter-revolution,
if you will. Counter-revolutionaries in 1939 to around 1944, 45, around the same time that the U.S. entered World War II, you had an increased crackdown by the FBI and the federal government on radical activities. You know, so you had a lot of that stuff swallowed up.
So it started that early, okay.
Yeah, and that's where you saw a lot of people arguing that that was probably the termination of an early movement, working class civil rights movement, instead of the petty bourgeoisie version that came about in the 1950s and 60s. You would have saw people addressing capital as being central to racism in the starting early, because you had A. Philip Randolph at that time, who you know, you had other socialist black leaders. You had a bunch of different groups coming in arguing about capital being central to oppression. But then, like I said, that crackdown came, Du Bois, Paul Robeson, a few other major black leaders who were making socialist arguments were blacklisted and repressed. So, you know, you saw the kind of split, and that's why we have to recognize that by in the 40s, you're going to see that, you know, what the film is arguing, that there is this actual, increased surveillance of African Americans, particularly in the working class communities, and making sure that their resources are stripped, and whatever they are offered are sub working class work. Discrimination in major labor unions continue, especially when you have AFL-CIO coming together, et cetera. You know, they push a lot of the rate of the people of the communists who are addressing race out of the CIO.
Yes,
you
know, right after the war.
After the war,
and at the same time they passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which put huge restrictions on what labor unions could do.
And that really,
you know, as far
hurt.
As secondary boycotts and what they call hot cargo, which was the common practice of union members when they saw something that was unloaded at their work site to refuse to handle it.
Yeah,
you know, if it wasn't union made, you know, and you know, all this came at the same time. And I mean, this done so, in my opinion, we're still reeling under the effects of this today.
Oh,
I
definitely.
Mean, it weakened the labor movement so bad. And also we got to remember too, I think, Gus, is that by 39-40, I mean, well, right up until December 7th, 1941, you know, the end of 1941, I mean, we were still in the depression.
Yeah.
And there were still a lot of strikes going on and
That's
stuff.
Right.
And, but nevertheless, the capitalists, you know, the economy had kind of had the most dangerous part, you know, it was past. They were starting to recover a little bit, and they started feeling confident. And that's when they started making moves politically to get their people into key government positions, and they weren't willing to be so submissive anymore. And basically this goes to the argument that that was the chance to have really made a real difference in American society, basically meaning to take control away from these banks and you know, large capitalists. Mm-hmm. That would have been the time to do it, because that's when they were weak. But instead they wormed their way back in, and then as soon as they were able, they started, you know, the empire struck back, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and it went on for quite a while. I mean, and then I think the biggest blow came when they really got their confidence back, of course, was starting in the late 70s.
Yeah.
You know, that's what we're really still suffering from.
Yeah, definitely, because there was so much action because of that repression across, not just in the U.S., but across the world, you had worker movements actually learning different strategies in organizing their people and having some very powerful labor militancy. A lot of good strikes, a lot of different groups coming together, and they saw that this was a powerful working class mm-hmm. situation that was happening. So of course you have these politicians and these business people going to these universities and getting these theorists who theorized this idea of neoliberalization. And this was something that was brand new. Now a lot of people didn't understand how it worked. So they went and got these scholars who actually wrote on a process of how to privatize every day.
One of the early ones was an Austrian guy. I can't remember his name. Yeah. He was an economist. He was Milton Friedman's, guru, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, Strauss, maybe? Yeah, I can't remember his name. I'll have to do some research on that. But yeah, you know, this is the thing. Everyone thinks things happen, you know, like in 1980, Ronald Reagan got elected. It's been downhill since then. Oh no, this was building for years, yeah. You know.
Reagan and Thatcher were just the
accumulate.
They were the ones that presented the newly revamped version of it. But people were doing it before Reagan and Thatcher came out. You had neoliberalization theorist papers out there that were going into effect in different countries.
And slowly and systematic building strength, exactly. Building, you know, increasing the numbers. And, you know, that's how things change. It doesn't happen suddenly usually. It's slow and systematic organizing and building and, mm-hmm. you know, expanding, you know. And, you know, in our society, it seems like, you know, of course, the mass media, you know, always tries to think that there's a spark and the right person happens to be there. And that's exactly. How it all changes. And that's not the case at all.
Which is why we, you know, a lot of people still use the great man theory,
yes.
Great woman theory. Well, again, like you said, you just made up a great point that that's not how history works and that's how society works. Most of the stuff that is going to happen major in the next 10 years is already being developed right now. You know,
yeah.
You know, so yeah, let's just be honest about that. One of my favorite people always tells me that Lou Turner, who was the big phenomenal scholar that we talked about, his biggest argument is always, you don't, by the time the bulldozers come and you decide to start picketing, you've already lost.
that's good.
They plan those bulldozers being there 10 years in advance, mm-hmm. particularly in urban cities. So. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you said you were saving a news story or two.
Yeah, definitely.
And then we're actually going to be possibly joined by another guest here in about, sometime in the next 20 minutes or so. Tariq Khan, who's a colleague of Gus's at the University mm-hmm. of Illinois
yes.
In the history department. And he's going to talk a little about with us with May Day. And he said there was a tentative thing he might not be able to make it, but he said he was 90% certain he could come. So in the meantime, you had something that you were saving?
Yeah. You know, every time I'm starting to think, okay, you know, even though President Obama is a neoliberal, you know, he's a petty bourgeoisie liberal at that, you know, he has a very disgusting idea about the black masses. You know, he does things every once in a while, like he's trying to do this stuff where he's freeing prisoners, you know, he's doing that, you know, so every once in a while he gives you kind of a glimmer that he may be onto trying to do something good in his last couple of months. But then he goes to the UK and he makes a lot of really bad statements and a lot of statements that prove, like what Christina was just talking about, that he has no idea of the experience of the working people in this country. The first thing, even I don't want to talk about, is that he told that black activists in the U.S. need to calm down
and need to
learn to negotiate. Like that was this kind of stuff he said in the UK. Besides that ridiculous, illogical, out of reality statement, he made some statements about the economy that will be interesting for our listeners. So according to an interview published in the New York Times this week, the president said that he is frustrated that Americans are not convinced by his administration's declarations of an economic recovery. According to the Times article.
Well, that's amazing that he realizes it.
Yeah, and listen,
okay.
This, it gets better.
Okay.
Obama feels, quote, vastly underappreciated, end quote,
mm-mm.
by the U.S. population for all the work he has done for them. So again, you know, this, what's so funny about this is that he's not looking at the numbers. And I got some numbers for people because people know I love my data. So he could start by directing his attention to the recent Brookings Institute report that details the growth of the number of people living in extremely poor neighborhoods. Listen to these numbers, people that are listening. Between the year 2000 and the period spanning 2010 and 2014, The number of people living in neighborhoods with a poverty rate higher than 40% grew by nearly 110%.
Whoa.
From 6.5 million to nearly 14 million.
Unbelievable.
So from 2000 to 2010-2014 time period, the number of people living in neighborhoods with a poverty rate higher than 40% grew by nearly 110%, meaning that there was more people that were living in poverty-stricken neighborhoods than were before in the 2000s. So again, that already kills his argument that there wasn't economic recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, here's some more. Out of the 45 million Americans who live in poverty, approximately 14% or 6.3 million of them now live in neighborhoods marred by extreme poverty. So we're not just talking about check to check, and we're not talking about, you know, payday loan places, check cashing, etc. We're talking about situations where food pantries are developing.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about places where cars are starting to disappear because people can't afford them anymore. So we're talking about extreme poverty situations in areas that had always had regular poverty to little poverty, mm-hmm. are now turning into extreme poverty. So again, that goes into the arguments that we've been talking about on the show for a while, that you see that this needs to be discussed in class, that the working class, which means that you have livable wage jobs and you can survive off of your check, are now being taken away, and most people are living in sub working class jobs and sub working class conditions where you have to have multiple revenues of income to try to get material conditions like food, shelter, and water. And then you also have that happening, and that swelling is leading to people dropping into the lumpen class or the lumpen proletariat, meaning engaging in illegal capitalism.
Yeah, for listeners that don't know the term lumpen or lumpen is a German word for rag. And yeah. It basically implies extremely poor, you know,
poor.
As like rags to riches kind of thing, you know, but yeah. Except no riches.
And they make their money outside of the American capitalist system. And
mm-hmm.
So that's why I prefer the term illegal capitalism, because they have to engage in competition
yeah.
to garner the most amount of wealth in terms of territory, et cetera. We're talking about usually drug dealing mm-hmm. or stealing, things like that. You know, that type of.
There's a big market for stolen iPhones. I mean, I saw a documentary yeah. on Netflix on it. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about an enterprise. I mean, a nationwide
yeah,
network.
You can make income to support your family off of stolen markets,
mm-hmm.
you know, black market goods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's just the way that the country is going. And a lot of people, the media is portraying this as something that people are doing because of a cultural issue.
Oh, please.
Like, people want to be a part of this because
it's
cool
yeah.
to do
it's fun
that.
To go to jail when you get caught and
yeah,
all that,
it's,
right.
It's fun to actually do this. And, you know, like, no, and that's why people really need to read Carol Stack's book, All Our Kin. That book that came out where Carol Stacks, an anthropologist, went into an urban city and lived with the people that were part of the sub working class, the lowest part of the working class, and also people in the lumpen or the illegal capitalist. And she saw that this was kind of like a no win situation. Like, you had to do something to feed your family, and you create these kinship networks where you shared goods with each other and actually support each other and